Welcome to Straight Up, brought to you by Peak Prosperity, which values context, curiosity, and learning that leads to action. Reading from his latest works and expanding on current events in the economy, energy, and environment, it is my pleasure to introduce your host, Dr. Chris Martinson.
Welcome and hello, everyone. This is your host, Chris Martinson, and thank you for tuning in for episode number 2 of Straight Up. And this is the version that goes out to our subscribers. Thank you to everybody who supports the work that Adam and I are doing. And I think it'll become more clear as I read through this next piece and expand on it, why it is that your support is just so critical. This is a two-parter, and the second part, the private part, the subscriber part, is titled Creating a World Worth Inheriting. And I want to talk to you about the opportunities that really excite me most right now. So this was first published in written form on Friday, May 17th, 2019. Today it is Sunday, May 19th, 2019. So this is about creating a world worth inheriting. Our mission at Peak Prosperity is to create a world worth inheriting every single day. We feel like we're doing everything we can to move towards this goal, but some days it feels like our efforts may not be nearly enough to get the job done. But while our own actions may be insufficient, they are necessary. That's something that we cover in the book Prosper, that idea of insufficient but necessary. And paired with the steps you take and those of hundreds of thousands of other peakprosperity.com readers, our odds for success exponentially improve. And I'd like to slip out of convincing mode for this piece. You know, because so many people still seem to be unaware of our many predicaments, I often find myself leaning towards lining up all the evidence in the hope that I can still open a few more eyes. You know, but the convincing mode, it's kind of a two-edged sword for me, because I know there's more convincing that needs to be done. I know that people are waking up however they're going to wake up. Maybe if I just give some more data, maybe if I just say it just the right way, that'll happen. But it doesn't really help to be in convincing mode all the time, right? So not today. We all know the score. You and I, everybody listening to this, we're collectively, we know this, right? That collectively we're on a terribly unsustainable course of action. The data, it's just overwhelming at this point. We're in an ecological collapse, as indicated by the fact that insects are disappearing for reasons unknown in quantities that are bafflingly rapid and alarming. There aren't even any really good workable theories for this at this point. To go off script here for a second, you know, it was just in February 13th, Popular Mechanics has a headline here: "The staggering worldwide decline of insects is a warning of ecosystem collapse." Right. So this is in Popular Mechanics. I think by the time Popular Mechanics is cluing you into insects, there's something going on. And what this article notes is that scientists from the China Academy of Agricultural Sciences, combined with the universities of Sydney and Queensland, they reviewed 73 existing reports of insect declines from around the world, found that insect biomass, so if you just measure them in tons, right, is falling by 2.5% a year. Over the past 30 years, that's 8 times faster than the rate of decline for mammals, for birds, for reptiles, for whatever we're doing, right? It's just absolutely crushing insects. And so the reasons for such a staggering rate of extinction, they say, come as a surprise to no one. Sure, loss of habitat, urbanization, deforestation, agriculture, stuff like that. They say that takes the number one spot, but they do note in this study, with pollution from synthetic pesticides and fertilizers, a very close second. So they even mentioned the neonicotinoids and fipronil. These are just awful, awful things. So I just wanted to raise that up right now, because I don't know what you do when insects are declining and we can't figure out how to yank the nasty chemicals off the market that we've put on in the last 20 years or so. At any rate, my own interpretation of the insect decline is that the rapture happened, only God took the insects up without a trace, left the humans. All right, just kidding. It really just has to do mostly with, I think, the deadly pesticides we're using. And we really just need to square up and face that. Meanwhile, the central banks, as we know, they're locked in a trap of their own making. They don't know what to do besides more of the same, which means ultra-accommodative financial policies that are spurring maybe one unit of economic growth. And by the way, I think the economic growth is going to kill us. One unit of that economic growth for every maybe 10 units of additional wealth gap, 5 units of ecological destruction. That's what Joseph Taner talked about when you go past the point of diminishing returns on your complexity curve. But there's another curve that we need somebody else to draw, which would talk about, well, I guess the limits to growth people did, that your economic growth becomes its own pursuit. And as you get more units of that, you rapidly take away more than that many units of other things that you need to live. So this socially, politically, ecologically dangerous policy is both logically and morally bankrupt. But there's nobody working at the central banks with enough courage to say so. Yeah, it's hard to be brave, right? And apparently economists are above average deficient in bravery. And finally, the old guard factions, political factions, as exemplified by Macron, Trump, May, Biden now, they cling desperately to this old narrative while something explosive is brewing beneath. Our work at Peak Prosperity is simply to observe the facts as best we can and draw our own conclusions. In fact, that's a very time-honored tradition. I came across these a couple of quotes that just caught me. One, it's noted that Aristotle, right? He lived, you know, about 350 BC, somewhere in that zone, recognized river deposits. So he used his eyeballs, recognized river deposits, realized that fossil seashells from rocks were similar to those found on the beach, indicating that fossils were once living animals. He deduced that the positions of land and sea had changed and thought maybe these changes occurred over long periods of time. And then Leonardo da Vinci, living between the 1450s up to about 1500 or so, 1520, he recognized that material carried by rivers to the sea was eventually compacted into sedimentary rock and later uplifted to form mountains. He concurred with Aristotle's view that fossils were the remains of ancient life as a byproduct of his engineering work on canals and rivers. God, what didn't this guy do? He studied the deposits of the Po River and concluded they must be at least 200,000 years old. He surmised that the whole of geologic time must be much longer. Now, think about the corresponding and surrounding avenues of study that these two gentlemen had to support these conclusions. And there wasn't a lot. In fact, in Da Vinci's time, there would have been a very strong church-based and working against him, church-based theology working against him even forming those ideas. But what did these two gentlemen do? Well, they used their eyes. They used their own senses. And I think this illustrates that we can see what's possible when you keep an open mind and let the facts before you tell the tale. You can be many thousands of years ahead of a broader cultural awareness of things like geology and geologic processes and the length of time and things like that. The signs, they're all around you if you choose to see them or intuit them. Either way you get to this knowledge is fine, right? And the young are getting restless and rightfully angry. And here I've inserted a picture. It's a cover of Time magazine. It's called The Next Generation Leaders. And it's a picture of Greta Thunberg sitting there in a very dramatic sort of a pose. So this is the 16-year-old girl who's galvanized this wonderful strike by young people against their political leaders for doing nothing about climate change and all the other changes that we see, maybe the loss of insects, things like that. So when your young people begin to lose connection with the direction that the culture is asking them to go, or that their elders are asking them to go along with them, that's part of that explosive thing brewing that I'm talking about. As well, the people of France. And I have some images next in the article that are from Act 26. That's the 26th week of protests. So that's a full half year And these pictures aren't, you know, it's not like we're down to like 10, you know, hippies with signs with like 42 grievances listed on them, sort of like, you know, milling about. This is center mass, tens of thousands of people in each one of these photos, just covered with yellow vests, some of them not yet wearing yellow vests, but just lots and lots of average, ordinary people of France. And again, the old guard media and political figures are so busy ignoring these movements that you probably are unaware of them, that you can't even find what's going on with the Yellow Vests. And the reason is simple. The Yellow Vest people are very much saying the system of governance, the system of centralized control, of the statist view of the world, these neoliberal policies that are so popular with the elites, right? Team Elite loves these policies. Why? Because it leads to many, many more billionaires, you know, several dozens of them. Meanwhile, everybody else is getting poorer, relatively speaking. But whether it's the Yellow Vests or it's Greta Thunberg or you have other more local experiences, you can feel it, can't you? That something's broken. It really can't be fixed by going backwards. That there's some journey that we're now all on that we must take. Those who still have some flexibility in their hearts and minds are already jumping to new ideas and narratives. I love this quote by Viktor Frankl that I've got next. He survived a concentration camp experience during the Holocaust, and it broke him open, that experience. And he has a very famous quote which says, "Between stimulus and response, there's a space. In that space is our power to choose our response. In our response lies our growth and our freedom." Eventually, these shifts that I'm noting here, they're going to become a flood, and everything will change seemingly overnight. So my personal focus, though, I'd like to recreate a few of the best conversations I had at the recent Peak Prosperity Seminar, and it's just a couple of them. God, I had so many great conversations, and those of you listening to this who had those conversations with me, you know what I'm talking about. They went all over the map. It was fabulous. Just so wonderful to be around, luxurious even, to be around people who you can have almost any conversation you could possibly imagine, and with no convincing, right? Just start with a shared background and keep moving. What a wonderful thing. And several of these conversations centered on the idea of where to live. And it's not a secret that I'm not really thrilled with my current location. Yes, it's, you know, I live in a close to a city center. It's nice to be able to walk to the cinema, to restaurants, shopping. It's a first in my life. And I really like that capability. I've always lived kind of more rurally. And on the other hand, however, I am on a very busy road. If you listen carefully, you might hear it in the background, even though I'm all the way underground in my basement recording this in my studio. And truthfully, I'd much rather live further away from so many people, given how I think the future is going to unfold. I had my garden raided last year while I was away at the Frontsite event. And so I'm not really a fan of either having to let go of all my hard work or guard it all the time. I would rather not do either of those things. I'd rather enjoy the fruits of my own labors and give away what I can. And this feeling I have, this is before things get any more difficult. Also, the community in which I live has a lot of great people in it, and it also has a raging opiate, drug, /alcohol problem, like so many other communities. In other words, it's already close to the edge, and this is with a supposedly strong economy. The bottom line is, I'm exploring options of where to live next. I've had a number of great conversations around this. I'm thinking really broadly. You know, I may decide to pick a new A location, you know, sell or rent this house, go get another primary house, or I may decide that I need a solid B location. And that could be as simple as a couple of acres somewhere more remote that I can get to easily. I can begin beautifying it, making it more abundant. I'll plant trees, fruit trees, nut trees. I'll amend the soil, do stuff like that. Or it may be more complicated and that I'll team up with other people and choose a shared plan B option. The idea is shared plan B. My preferred idea at the moment, just something I've been noodling, would be to go in on a campground or an RV park, already zoned as such, no zoning fights, in an absolutely beautiful, abundant setting that would allow us all to put gorgeous small houses up. Well, when I say on the lot, because they'd still have to have an axle underneath to qualify as an RV. So this is a great idea. RV parks have very different zoning and very different requirements around them. If you want to have individual houses, I live in a state, and I think most states do this. Well, now everybody's got to have their own septic system, which is very expensive, or tied into sewer. Everybody's got to have their own, amount of acreage or lot lines. It's very cumbersome. The studies I've read say that the zoning and building requirements for single family homes now starts about $85,000 of the cost of a house before you've done anything. You haven't turned over a single shovelful of dirt, is just meeting all of those various requirements. So you're up to 85 grand and you haven't even got a house yet. All right, so with an RV park though, or with a campground, there's very different sorts of requirements around that, which means that you can have a lot of that shared infrastructure. So when it comes to sewage or things like that, or the water systems, or heating, all things like that, you can, it's very different. All right, well, I showed some examples just to get some ideas going. If you go to the site, check out the printed version. There's some very nice pictures of what these little fun little places might look like. And so there's a variety of options that could range from, say, $30,000 on up to, well, as much as you want to spend. But you know, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 will get you a really nice, beautiful, small-ish home. You know, I guess they would be in the range of anywhere from 500 to maybe 1,000 square feet, something like that. So imagine a series of these, really beautiful and just gorgeous, right? In a gorgeous spot, a place people would really want to go. Opening up the chance of offering these for camping, rentals, or Airbnb spaces, which could easily cash flow positively. And then if enough people went in on this idea, I don't know, 6, 8, 10, whatever it is, then a location could be offered for a young couple to manage. And they'd be responsible for the plantings, the gardens, watching over the place, managing the bookings if it's being rented out. And the rest of us would be responsible for putting up the capital and then showing up for one or two designated weeks a year. Each year, everybody invested has to show up to practice living together, getting to know each other, doing things together, having a fun time, of course, and then learning the various systems. I don't know, there might be solar systems or water systems or learning how the permaculture works, just learning whatever the systems are, right? And as well, we might consider having someone manage ordering and filling a set of storage containers with various items that we recommend, you know, just in case, right? And they're not that expensive. $3,000-$4,000 and you get these shipping containers. I just ordered one. I have one here on my property. It was very easy to order. It was what's called a single trip. I mean, it had been used once. This beautiful steel container with a teak floor had been built somewhere, and then stuff got shipped here to the United States, and that it wasn't worth shipping the container back. So basically, almost it feels like for the cost of hauling, I got this thing, very cheap. As a side note, too, some of these containers, they can be really rapidly and cheaply modified to live in. They stack well, of course, so you could have them be two layers high, even three if you wanted to, with appropriate bracing. And there are a lot of plans on the internet for doing just that in the time between recording this and when the article got posted. Somebody mentioned that, of course, these storage containers are already tricked out for construction offices. So they already come with wiring and floors and insulation, lighting, stuff like that. So there's already fairly cheap ways to do all of this. And I think ways that are actually quite functional and even elegant when you look at them. So in any event, having some of these items stacked maybe on the back of the property filled with emergency supplies, I think that would go a long ways towards alleviating many people's concerns about not being prepared. And if any of that seems at all overly anxious, and I know some of you live with reluctant partners or even inside of yourself, you're thinking, oh gosh, this sounds a little dark. Please understand it's really only retail level citizens that are discouraged from making such plans for themselves. The military stockpiles for emergencies. Of course they do. We'd be mad if they didn't. Federal agencies, same thing. As do a lot of very wealthy people. Adam and I know tons of extremely wealthy people who are prepared at levels I'm reticent to even tell you about, lest you think I'm making things up to sway you. And so my question is, why is it that self-reliance is only discouraged socially among the 99% and below crowd? You know, it's weird but true. So imagine a place, maybe 20 to 100 acres in size. It's got a pond or river feature, other water, something like that. It's got open arable land. It's got fruit and nut trees, permaculture installations being managed, good solar exposure, and all the basic amenities, such as electricity, a common septic, laundry, clubhouse of some sort, high-speed internet, maybe some hot tubs. Oh, and our tribe of curious, motivated people all hanging out there from time to time. It would be your choice to own an actual RV to park there, a tiny house on an axle, or maybe you just want a plot of land and you're going to put a tent up or a yurt, whatever. To me, that would be a plan B I could get really excited about. And there are lots of other possible ideas too. I'm wide open to those as well. Just getting the ball rolling here with some thinking I've already put into this. Other people shared their own views of what would get them excited, and with lots of talk of Costa Rica or other expat options being pretty common, and as well as the old standby of finding a nice spot and putting up your own house there and digging in to make it better. I did go to Costa Rica and examined it, and I loved the idea. It felt so different to be in a country that wasn't actively marketing fear and ignorance to itself, where pura vida, pure life, is the defining ethos, and to be around a place with just so much natural beauty, abundance, and life still was wonderful. And I could absolutely see wanting to have a closer connection with a place where there's still that much vibrancy of life. Loved it. What I did not hear very much of is people saying that they were completely happy with where they currently lived. And if I had to guess, possibly as three-quarters of the assembled tribe was wide open to the idea of living somewhere else besides their current location. So that's how epidemic and endemic it is for people to want to begin to associate more with their tribe. So chief among the concerns, of course, was exactly that. It was not having like-minded people around them with which to share the journey. So in part one of this report, I talked about the journey from survival to significance. Well, if you don't have people around you who are even having those conversations, if you don't have people around you who understand the larger context of why you feel the urge to bring your best self into this moment of time, that's inhibitory. It's not life-affirming. It's contractive. It's not expansive. Well, I know it's a complicated equation to solve because, of course, there's jobs, there's family, there's kids involved. Then there's the problem of trying to guess which regions might fare better or where the local culture might be already most resilient. And most unpredictably now, for me, the weather is turning things upside down, making it really hard to plan. The Midwest, it's flooding again. In some cases, they're reporting rainfalls that they've never seen in 100 to 150 years of record keeping. The West, it catches on fire now, and when it's not doing that, it's flooding. And here in Western Mass, we're on something like our 35th day of rain out of the past 40. Well, it's been way below average in terms of temperature. Very difficult growing conditions. I feel terribly for the local small farmers. So where to go? Well, eventually you just have to choose, and that's the next part. I'm going to host a small gathering somewhere in my neck of the woods in June to discuss these very issues and to gauge people's actual desire to put in some real effort and capital to get something going. This would be more of a planning, it's brainstorming session than a decision-making event, right? We're not going to pick something. I'm talking about a nice focused conversation around the basic elements of expanding or changing one's living situation. So if you're in New England / New York, you want to attend, please email me at chris@peakprosperity.com. Let me know a little bit about your interests and reasons for wanting to attend, and I'll send out more information once I figure out the size of the gathering. I've already heard back from some of you based on the printed report, so that's wonderful, and this thing will happen. For those who are interested but cannot come, I'll gather all the combined output and make that available in some form or another. Now I want to turn to another set of conversations centered on the idea of how to be. How to be during these troubled times, especially in support of the younger people. So I titled this section, On Being an Elder. My eldest daughter, Erica, was 24 at the time, and she was at a Stephen Jenkinson event, it was at Roe, when an older person approached her, and with the best of intentions, said to her, Erica, I just want to say how sorry I am for how my generation has left you such a mess. Can you forgive me?" Well, because she's so wise, Erica immediately rejected that, telling the woman she had no interest in taking on the burden of forgiveness as one more thing from the prior generations. And while the intention of this lady was well meant, her actions were actually 180 degrees opposite from the proper role of an elder. And hearing Erica recount that reminded me of hearing a story once told by Michael Mead. He's a great storyteller and anthropologist, I guess you'd call him also, almost, about the role of elders versus olders, in which he made the case that the job of the elders is to carry the weight so the young people don't have to. And I've inserted a couple of audio clips for you to peruse if you want to hear more about Michael Mead and how he tells these stories. But the very last thing elders should be doing at this particular moment in time is to try and hand more weight to the young. "Here, Erica, carry my burden. Hand me some forgiveness. I'm feeling burdened with what my generation has done. Please relieve me of that." So what exactly does that mean to carry the weight, though? Well, let's agree that in the best of times, when everything's lots to look forward to, even in the best of times, moving out of childhood into a productive adulthood, that is some trying business. It's hard work. It's challenging. It's frightening. And sometimes ends in complete failure. In these modern times, there are so many things working against the young, not least of which is a badly diminished sense of the future. So in the best of times, it's hard turning into an adult. In these times, it's even harder. So what does it mean then to carry the weight if that weight includes the prospect of the world becoming uninhabitable for humans? I mean, that you got to admit, that's on the possibility set. You can look at the data and conclude, as many young people have, which is why I brought Greta Thunberg into this, and lots of young people have this view now. How do you help carry the weight for a young person who's concluded maybe that we're making the world a completely uninhabitable place? Now, I don't know the answer to that, except to say that saying sorry is the wrong approach, as is avoiding the topic altogether. So there's some middle ground in there, which we're going to have to explore together. And one thing I know, and another part that we got at the seminar was having Mike Basta, again, he's a Gottman relationship therapist, came and walked us through some exercises, which we did last year, we did it this year at the seminar, which are really around listening. And he relayed that there are multiple levels of listening. You know, one is you're not actually listening at all. You're thinking about something completely different when a person's talking to you. Another level is you're listening, but really you're just waiting for the other person to stop because you already have something you need to say that's burning away in your mind. So you're not really listening. Another layer is you're actually listening and listening carefully enough that you can reflect back to the person what they've said. And then there's a layer beyond that where you're listening with your whole being. And an elder, I believe an elder listens with an intensity that lets the younger person in this example know they're not just being heard, but seen. The elder has paid close attention to their own lives. Yes, they've got accumulated experience to share, which sometimes combines to take the form of just listening and letting the younger person make their own mistakes, knowing that that's the fastest way to grow. In short, listening is a dance between the youngster and the elder, with both growing and learning from the experience of being mentored and being the mentor. Both are changed by that dynamic, and both have an equally valuable role to play. Beware, elders, the young, they have plenty to be angry about. Consider the responses to the twin questions of when did you know and what did you do about it? The oil executives, consider the responses that these oil executives might give when confronted with these minutes from a 1980 meeting they held on their own internal climate modeling exercises, where right here I've got an image pulled from that particular document. They talked about their model said, well, looks like global average 2.5 degrees Celsius rise expected by 2038. And If we get this 5-degree rise by 2067, their models anticipated globally catastrophic effects. Oh, yeah, they might say, you know, here's a quote that an oil executive might say, yeah, we kind of knew all that back in 1980. So that's when we knew. What did we do? Nothing. Well, actually not nothing. We buried the information and went on with our business of making more money by extracting more oil. And as I said, you know, anger is actually a legitimate response by the young to that, as are infuriation, maybe even revulsion, right? And interestingly, from that 1980 document, there was also another nugget where they said the timescale for significant impact was going to be very roughly 50 years, which is the year 2030 in this story, and that the time for action for market penetration theory says there's no leeway, meaning that we have to get started right then, back in 1980, transitioning to a new energy future. So first, the CO2 projections from their internal model are actually dead nuts on here 39 years later. And second, the time to significant impact seems pretty spot on too, coming in at around 2030. But it's the last part in bold that's the real killer here. It takes 40 to 50 years to transition from one fuel source to another. And the oil execs had that information too, noting that even back in 1980, with a 50-year lead time, there was effectively no leeway for inaction. And what did we collectively do as a nation in 1980 when armed with this information? Well, we fired Jimmy Carter, elected Reagan, and went on a financialization spree that gutted the middle classes and created financial super elites with no allegiance to anything but their own piles of money. So the same critical two-part questions could be asked of Monsanto, Syngenta, and Bayer, the three main purveyors of the toxic chemicals ravaging our bodies and our environment. Killing the insects, right? What did you know, Monsanto and Bayer? When did you know, and what'd you do about it? Well, listen, I guarantee you there are internal documents there too, noting the life-damaging effects of glyphosate and neonicotinoids and other things. But it didn't matter, because it was all about the money. Remember the last piece I wrote, I talked about mammon? If you haven't really read that, to me, that's been a great organizing idea. This idea that it's for the love of money, our relationship to money. It's mammon as the embodiment or the metaphor for talking about how greed and avarice and our relationship to money is really to blame here. Because look, I don't think there's anybody actually working at Bayer, for instance, who would say, you know what, I'm going to take a flamethrower and wipe out, you know, thousands of baby birds and millions of insects and maybe, you know, give leukemia to a couple of kids, right? They wouldn't do that directly. But you put 1 degree of freedom between their actions and those results, and you call it money, and that's good enough. That's it. That's something I think we need to understand about humans and being human, is that even with 1 degree of freedom, 1 degree of separation between our actions and the effects, that's enough to confuse us. That's enough to allow our rationalization processes to take over and say, well, you know, if I wasn't going to do it, somebody else would do it. Hey, everybody's doing it. It's not really happening. It's too complex. We can't really know that my action led to that result. Whatever the rationalization processes are, shows that we're actually not all that sophisticated, because we should be able to note the absolute decline in living standards, living quality, and life forms, and connect our actions to those things. Should be easy, but it's not. And throughout every major industry, we'd probably find a similar set of stories, right? Somebody calculated at some point, well, seatbelts cost X, but we're going to have Y deaths if we don't do it, and we'll get Z suits out of that. Okay, we'll put seatbelts in. But there are other things where safety wasn't undertaken because it wasn't worth it, right? The olders in this story, they're the ones who spent their lives covering up these things so they could have jobs and money. And that needs to be spoken to directly. Don't ask for forgiveness around that, but own up to it directly. Big difference. The young, they already know this. And listen, maybe they, the young, would have made exactly the same decisions if they were teleported back in time. But here we are, and the young are the ones who are left holding the bag and having to face cleaning all of this up. And none of this is to say that blame needs to be aside. That's not part of the process. We're not asking for forgiveness. But neither can the prior generations pretend they didn't know or that they did everything they could. What did they know? When did they know? What did they do about it? Because that's clearly not the case. So the conclusion I come to here is that as of right now, when I wrote this on May 17th, I haven't had a drink in 317 days as of that writing. And on July 4th, 2019, it's going to be a full year. And several of you at the seminar, I talked about this openly at the seminar, you're really quite interested in this part of my life, which I freely share publicly now. And I'm happy to share this further with anybody who's interested. I'm not here to push it on anybody. I'm just here to observe this and offer this in case it's useful to you. One important thing that I have learned from attending AA meetings is that you really do have to admit to a problem before you can address it at all, let alone effectively. And by the way, as an aside, AA meetings are really an amazing treasure, international treasure, because they're the only place I've found so far in my culture where strangers show up, share a first name, and then openly share really shameful things about their lives and their actions. And it doesn't cost anything. In fact, the whole AA philosophy is dead set against profiting from it, proselytizing about it, any of that. People find their way there, and they share things that are more real, more brutal, more tangible than any other place I found so far. It's pretty astonishing that way. All of this leads around to this idea, though, that you have to admit to a problem before you can address it. So to create a world worth inheriting, well, I think there we have to begin with the admission that our society is currently not doing that. As humans, we're creating a series of messes and insolvable predicaments that are really just mostly rooted in our cultural inability to admit those truths. Stephen Jenkinson thinks this is rooted in our inability to face mortality. It's our own death phobia that leads us to pretend as if the end is never going to come, and it allows us, again, with that one degree of separation, that little bit of isolation between our thought patterns and the reality of the world, is sufficient to allow us to completely ignore things that and rationalize away things that maybe we should be paying attention to and not rationalizing away. All around the edges, people are figuring this out and responding by taking better care of themselves, their neighbors, their local ecology and environment. Thousands of examples of this now. In other corners, people are giving up and checking out, right? They're wallowing in their own learned helplessness by playing video games to excess. They're numbing. They're otherwise distracting themselves from this brilliant experience that's life. Both groups actually represent opportunities to reach out and provide support. You know, the first group of people who are out there responding and taking better care of themselves and the world, well, they're your natural allies. And the second group, however, those who've checked out, they represent an untapped source of energy that just needs a reason to find meaning and purpose in life again. That's where I think this is why things are going to change so rapidly when they do, because it's holding that beach ball underwater. Nobody wants to go through life numbed out and all that. It's once you check into the brilliance of life and how amazing it is to be in the flow of it, to be a creator, to be part of it, it's an astonishing, wonderful thing to be in the flow of life. And so our natural state is to be alive and connected. And so to the people who aren't alive and connected, I think they need a reason to be alive and connected. And I've been connecting these dots for a while, in particular around this concept of demoralization, which is really a condition which happens when your cognitive map breaks down and no longer maps to this thing we're trying to call life or reality. And so there too, the people who are demoralized, they're not a big suckhole of low energy that, you know, you have to pour energy into to recover. They're just people who are looking, who I think have rightly concluded that their gifts don't align well with the world. As Jay Krishnamurti said, it is no measure of health to be well adjusted to a profoundly sick society. So the people who are demoralized, the first step is not is admitting the problem, but you got to admit the right problem. The first step isn't, hey, demoralized person, let me help you get back into the center mass of life over here, the right response is to say, you know what? There's nothing wrong with you. There's nothing wrong with the world. Nothing wrong with you. You are perfectly well-adjusted. The problem is this world you're being asked to live into, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't work for you. It doesn't work for all sorts of life. There are lots of people for whom our modern consumer-led life is not even worth living, really. And so they check out. They become demoralized. So I think there's an opportunity there. Reach these people, and we reach them by saying, nothing wrong with you. There's nothing wrong with you. There's something wrong with the world. The only thing that's wrong here is we need more people understanding that we need their gifts to begin getting us back on the right track. Please join us in that, right? So quite hopefully, we are seeing that such causes really are arising very rapidly right now. The Extinction Rebellion, which is really gaining traction. I'm a big fan of this too. It's sort of a parallel effort to the Yellow Vests. The Extinction Rebellion, it shut down whole chunks of London recently in protest. So this is one group. Here's a quote from an article I'll quote from right now. Quote, "The Extinction Rebellion has a message for the world. We've only just begun." After paralyzing parts of London, the co-founder of environmental group Extinction Rebellion has a message for the world. We've only just begun. The group disrupted London with 11 days of protest that it cast as the biggest act of civil disobedience in recent British history. Iconic locations were blocked, the Shell building defaced, trains stopped, Goldman Sachs targeted. The aim, a rebellion against the political, economic, and social structure of the modern world in time to avert the worst devastation outlined by scientists studying climate change. So what's next? For the next phase of what she describes as a movement fueled by love, Gail Bradbrook, a co-founder of Extinction Rebellion, told Reuters she wanted to provoke a mass refusal to repay debt that would upend the financial system. Economic growth tends to require the taking of resources from the earth, so something has to change on a debt-based economy, she said. That would entail a mass refusal to pay off mortgages and student loans. Debt resistance groups in Britain, the United States, and elsewhere argue that refusing to pay debts would spark discussion about alternatives to the global system. End quote. Yeah, I love it. Go. I would only advise the leaders of this movement to avoid small planes, toasters near hot tubs, and nail guns. I'm only partly joking. Why would they need to avoid those things? Going after the central pillar of control is the idea that money and debt are inviolable contracts. That's really dangerous business. History's full of martyrs that took on the banking system directly. Money is power. Power is power. Going after either straight on, hey, that's risky business. And it always has been. Today's no different. Just anybody who thinks today is different, when did humans evolve? That's what I need to know. It hasn't happened. So I think the aims of this Extinction Rebellion, they're spot on. Disrupt the system. Absolutely. Disrupt it by refusing to play by its rules. According to Daniel Quinn, the only way to effectively disrupt a human pyramid of control is to walk away from it. While there's nowhere to walk to anymore, literally. I mean, once upon a time, you could walk back into the jungle and next thing you know, there's just some ruins in Guatemala. There's nowhere to walk anymore. One can figuratively stop playing their game. And debt-based money, that's right at the very heart of it all. All of this then leads to the idea that to create a world worth inheriting, we have to first admit that we're not on track to do that. And then we must be willing to change on a very deep level. First, internally, so we can be proper elders and compatriots to those around us, and as well externally, as we move into a life of consuming less. Living more, but consuming less. Increasing our quality of life, but maybe reducing our living standards as measured by stuff. Maybe even making sacrifices at some point, including laying down our lives for the things we love and in which we believe. This is what I think the Extinction Rebellion is doing. That energy is coming up. People, it's only a short hop, skip, and a jump between when this bubbling dissatisfaction goes over the top of the pot and things change very, very rapidly. If Aristotle and Da Vinci could work out the ages and mechanisms of geology without any supporting scientific frameworks, I think we can at least work out for ourselves that this unsustainable mess of a program we call our economy has an expiration date. And then it's up to us to plan accordingly, based on what our own eyes, our own ears, and our own hearts are telling us is true. My heart tells me there's a better way, one that does not involve squabbling like primitive monkeys over key resources. Instead, I look around and I see people using their big brains to work with nature, create abundance, and believe in ourselves as creative forces for good. And that's where the power in this story lies, with you understanding your power to change the future. Let's create a world worth inheriting. Thank you for listening.